On March 15th, 2004, Lordi released her second album, The Monsterican Dream, a record that brought many Monster Maniacs much joy through songs like Blood Red Sandman, My Heaven Is Your Hell, and Children of the Night, to name a few. To celebrate the 20th anniversary of this album, we're going to jump back in time and uncover some of the stories about this period that we haven't covered before. Of course, we've discussed and documented the story of this album during the first season of this series, so go back and listen to that if you haven't already. But for this special episode, we're going to look at the album through a different lens and dig up some details we didn't reveal before. I'm your host, Matthew Kessie, and this is
Manchester What the Lord is Doing.
You are listening to the Monster King and the Shield Special.
Following the release of Get Heavy in 2002 and the conclusion of the tour and festival cycle of that era at Wacken Open Air on August 1st, 2003, work soon began on the next Lordi record.
If I remember correctly, I think the atmosphere was really great, and pretty much everyone was participating, you know, the songwriting. And you know, Get Heavy, it was basically Mr. Lordi's album, because he made all of the songs like in a long time. There was like a millions of demos before that. We just chose the songs for that. But then when we started the second album, we kind of like started from the scratch. So everyone was giving their ideas and some demos and stuff like that. So that was the first like Lordi as a band album, like for me at least.
Much like Lordi's then drummer and backing vocalist Keita has stated, Kalma, Lordi's bassist of the time, felt similarly optimistic prior to heading into the studio.
If I remember correctly, it was pretty good, because we had like success out of the first album, and we had a great couple of tours and shows in all over Europe. So, and for example, I was excited to go to studio, because The Monsterican Dream is my first like commercial album, the album that record company paid. So, so it's a very, very meaningful and special album to me.
One of the key differences between Get Heavy and The Monsterican Dream was that Lordi's first album was a culmination and selection of nearly a decade of Lordi demos, refined and polished by Mr. Lordi since 1992. Whereas with the second album, the vast majority of tracks were newly written and composed by Mr. Lordi, and this time by other members.
Because in Get Heavy, we basically just played our parts.
Right. Because
the songs were pretty much the songs were there already when I joined. But now it was like, I think that Mr. Lordi also he even though he had millions of demos, but he kind of like started to write new music as well. He didn't use the old ones. Maybe some bits and pieces here and there, but basically also he started to write new material.
When it came to the proposition of recording a new album and writing new material, Mr. Lordi was quite surprised by how quickly this came around.
And I was like happily surprised that they asked. Well, like I was like, already? Now? Really? That's okay. A good album? Cool. Yay. Let's do it. That's what I remember. And I remember coming up with the Blood Red Sandman, the idea, well, Blood Red Santa, and the riff for that, and some other stuff like Children of the Night. And then I really wanted to do, I remember writing Bring It On, Yeah, I remember writing that one because I really wanted to do like an intro song out there, or the opening track that would be like kind of like Come Out and Play from Twisted Sister meets Inside the Electric Circus from Wasp.
Now, despite new songs being written for the record, there was, of course, influence from older demos here too, but this time not necessarily Lordy demos, but that of Mr. Lordy's old joke band, Double Beaten Bodies.
Between PK Hill and Peter Riski that we had this band.
Okay.
And by that time we had actually had other people there in the band too. But that was like a therapy band, or just for fun band. But from that band there's quite a few songs, as you might know, you know, ended up being Lordy songs, you know, in the end. So there's, for example, Wake the Snake. I remember that was on the demo version. It was called The Goddess of Rock and Roll, which Ennery loved. She was really bummed that the title, you know, that we changed the title. She really loved The Goddess of Rock and Roll, wonder why. But that song was originally a Double Beaten Bodies song called Bischofen and Rock and Roll. And Bischofen is a city in, or a town in Germany. And for some reason, PK Hill was using it. It was a code word for beer, Bischofen. When he said, hey, let's go have some Bischofen. And that means, let's go have some beer. Okay. And, you know, shit like that. And there's also Shotgun Divorce, that is, you know, Beaten Bodies song that was called, I think it was just Dr. Pepper. Yeah, the song was about Dr. Pepper.
On Lordy's first album, Get Heavy, the group was fortunate to be in the hands of trusted and well-renowned legendary Finnish producer T.T. Oksala. On this occasion, with a new, darker sound in mind and grimmer lyrics written, a new producer was in the booth to help the band fulfill their musical and tonal vision.
I started very, very early. My grandmother was an opera singer, so I started to do recordings at church for her students, because she was a pedagogue for opera singers. So I was like 12 years old. I started doing recordings, and I formed my first home studio at the age of 15, I guess, 4-track C cassette setup. And then band started to come in to our home, and then I moved to work one studio in Helsinki and created a lot of demos in Helsinki scene, like him and Valtari and many bands who got record deals later. And then I moved to Finvox studio from there, and I was traveling quite a lot next 7 to 8 years. I was working in like 10 countries, something like that, and I escaped here to a little bit countryside, to Hämeenlinna, and I've been here now like over 10 years.
Healy Hillesma was the producer who gladly took the task of working with Lordy to create the Monsterican Dream. However, this wasn't meant to be the first time he would produce an album with the group.
I remember it quite well. I was working with BMG quite a lot during that time, and with the A&R guy called Asko Kallonen. Asko called me that he, I don't know why, but he told me that he thinks that I can understand all the weird stuff. I don't know why. So, and then he told me that he's got some material, interesting material from this band called Lordy. And he sent me with a normal post, and there was a letter coming for me, and it included CD and a couple of promo pictures of Lordy. Like, they look even today. So I was really amazed at what is this. And then I went with Asko to their, I still lived in Helsinki during that time. So we went with Asko to their rehearsal place to somewhere in eastern Helsinki. And they played like one set for us. And we were just two of us sitting there. And it was really cool. And But then we couldn't match the schedules, and that was happening in 2002, I think, or one.
Okay.
And because I was working with him and 69 Ice also during that period of time, so we're talking about it.
Okay.
Tete Oksala, the legendary Finnish producer, rest in peace, did the first one, and then I came into the second one.
Okay.
It was funny because yesterday, exactly 20 years ago, I started doing the vocal recordings with Lordi. I checked out my diary.
Oh, really? Oh, cool.
Yes.
Okay.
So we started 28th of January 2004, the recordings. And we had only 3 weeks for recordings non-stop and 2 weeks for mixing. So 5 weeks in total, non-stop. So, and I checked, we were working also in Saturdays and some Sundays. So
nice.
It was really, really packed session.
Before we proceed to looking at the songs featured on the record, one element that will give us a greater understanding of Healy's approach with Lordi is what he determines are the key aspects of his job as music producer.
So the first thing is, of course, musical. You have to have like musical sense that you can understand musical ideas, arrangements, composing, top lining, all that stuff. And the second is the technical knowledge. You have to understand technology, how the gear work, and you have to communicate with a record engineer and think about the correct studios for each project and so on and so on, and listen to artist visions and then convert those to technical steps. And the third one is economic knowledge. So you have to understand something about the budget and payments and royalties, copyrights, and you have to monitor the budgets as well during the recording sessions. So, and the fourth one, which is really maybe the most important here, you have to have some kind of knowledge about interaction and communication skills, social skills, because it's humans who are working and all the people are super different from each other. And especially these days when people work in many places with their laptops and different countries at the same time. So handling kind of working with creative people, that's really in the center.
When it came to working with the individuals in the band, Healy first starts off here and he says that he was quite delighted with how laid back Mr. Lordi was when it came to recording his vocals.
Probably the most easygoing vocalist I ever worked with.
Really? Okay, cool.
So, I still, when I'm talking with younger producers in university, I quite often use Lordi as an example that he's the most laid-back vocalist I ever worked. And some people need 1 day, 2 days, or whatever hours to prepare themselves and start vocals little by little, but Lordi was just saying, okay, I asked him, can we start doing the vocals now? And he said, okay, I will smoke 2 cigarettes and I'm ready.
Keita and Kalma were also highly regarded in terms of musicality and skillfulness by Healy during the recording sessions.
The drummer during that time.
Yes, yeah.
And he was a most professional musician of the guys.
Okay.
And he nailed the drums quite fast, as far as I remember. So,
nice.
And he was really big. And he's producing some stuff these days also. So he was a little bit into production as well. So it was quite fluent, as nice. Far as I remember.
Okay, awesome.
To play with him. And the bass, he was really a talent player as well. So I don't remember any problems there. Then with the guitars, Eamon, I remember he had quite serious problems with timing and he was rushing quite a lot. So I remember that it took quite a lot of time to get tight doubled rhythm guitars to the album.
With regards to the keyboard on the album, Healy recalls that there was some pre-production issues with Enery's part on The Monsterican Dream.
The case was that she hadn't been prepared at all, almost at all. So that was a little bit tricky because we had a really tight schedule and there was no, Lordi had done all the programming for keyboards. So it was just, you know, maybe playing just some chords or something, but it was we kind of missed the pre-production phase, so that there wasn't clear idea about the keyboard. So that I remember that took some time to try to find something. And I think the feeling was that, of course, everybody wanted to get her involved because she's in the band, so we kind of had to find something for her to perform as well, because of course natural.
The Monsterican Dream stands out in the Lordi discography due to its emphasis on character-driven songs, often based around or influenced by the monsters of Lordi.
I remember I wanted everybody to have their own shock cameo, or, you know.
Okay.
And of course with Kita there was no problem.
Yeah,
you know, all right. And then he opened up his vault and started like, and he pushed like a lot of stuff, if I remember correctly, like every time.
Yeah.
And yeah, Eamon, you know, and he did his fashion dolls. I think Kita was helping him out, or, you know, they were co-writing that somewhat. I was like really, really firm on the fact that everybody should have their own song.
Okay.
You know, everybody should have their own shock meter.
Yeah.
You know.
With the members of Lordi all now fully participating, one of the most overjoyed at this proposition was Kita.
At first, of course, we did the demos.
Yeah.
I remember we did I was basically producing all of the demos, and then I made my demos as well, and I guess I did like maybe 4 or 5 songs.
Okay.
And I just made some. I remember Pet the Destroyer was called only Destroyer, and then I can't remember what was Haunted Town. And then of course we had that B side To Hell with the Pop, that was B side for Blood of the Sandman. That was also my song. It was called Nightmares. And I guess I maybe had like 5 demos and I got like 3 songs. So for me that was kind of like the lottery, because I've always I've always been like writing songs, and that was one of my biggest dreams, even though I played drums in Lordi, but I was singer, and second I was a songwriter. So of course that was, for me, that was really cool that I got that many songs to album.
Yeah.
Theoretical Trailer. I was basically doing that whole like production wise. I was like doing those effects, and I guess I was also recording the speaks as well, but then Healy just like mixed it down and did the rest of it. But I was basically doing it, because at the time I was studying like music production, so at that time I had my own Pro Tools already. With first album I didn't have that yet. When we were doing Monsterican Dream, I already had my own like production kit, and I started that as well. So that was also why I was participating that much.
One of the most widely beloved of these character-focused songs by fans was, of course, Calmageddon, a song centered around Lordi's ghostly skeletal bassist, Calma.
I mean, that succeeded the most. I mean, that came out the best, even though there was... I'm sure that you spoke with Calma that the bass. I mean, we have a different view on the Imus bass riff there, because I said do something along the lines kind of similar to Michael Jackson's Thriller, and to me he made exactly notes note on the same riff. And I said this is not, you know, kind of like not the same riff. And he said this is not the same riff, and he still remembers that in his mind it wasn't the same riff. To me, I still remember that it was the same riff.
Yeah,
you know, that it was like and for some reason he doesn't remember that. He remembers that, no, it wasn't like that. But
And I have been always like fascinated for the songs that have like the same bass line throughout the song. For example, in this case, it was like Michael Jackson's Thriller was in mind. And my actually, I don't even remember my first version of this song. But Tommy is like insisting that it sounded really much too much like the Michael Jackson's Thriller.
Okay.
So I had to change it a little bit. But I don't have any demos from that first version. I really can't remember what it sounded like. But well, I came up with the main riff, actually, basically all the riffs and the verse and the pre-chorus. I think they are mine. Actually, the melodies are also mine, but always been bad in choruses. So I didn't have any chorus. And
right.
Then when we got put that song together, then I don't even remember where Tommy got the idea from. He had been doing songs with PK Hell in the past, so they had some great chorus, and we put it there, and it just worked.
As previously stated by Healy, Lordi's guitarist of the time, Eamon, was having some notable difficulties when it came to the rhythm guitar timings. One song in particular proved tricky, that being Pet the Destroyer, so much so that Keita actually ended up recording the rhythm guitar for that song.
Thing that no one knows, that Keita also plays some guitar on that album.
Oh, really?
Okay. Yeah.
Right.
I remember when we were recording Pet the Destroyer and Hornet Town and To Hell with the Pop.
Yeah.
And it was there with like producer Healy was there, and of course Mr. Raymond, and then I was there. Mm. Because when I did the demos, I played all of the guitars. So I was basically there showing Mr. Raymond that okay, it goes like this and it goes like that, and we kind of like did it together, even though he was playing the guitar.
Mm.
And then there was this one part, I guess it was Pet the Destroyer song, that Mr. Eamon was kind of like struggling a little bit. Like, how does this go?
Mm.
And then Healy was kind of like, well, show him. And I was like, and then he gave me his like beloved Les Paul, and I like, well, it goes this, and then Eamon is kind of, well, what the hell, you play it, and then I played it, and it's there. So that was something that nobody really knows until now.
In hindsight, when we look back at the guitar on Get Heavy and the Monsterican Dream, the guitar solos are quite short and snappy. There was even at one point a solo to be introduced into Blood Red Sandman, but this wasn't included in the track. Eamon, back during our original interviews in 2020, tells us here.
Maybe if I would have been I don't know, Young New Moms then.
Yeah.
The album have sounded different. There would have been probably like 1 minute solo in the beginning of each song. But, you know, I remember that there was, for example, a Blood Red Sandman on Monsterican Dream.
Yeah.
And everybody wanted to have a solo on that song. Like, okay, and there's a guitar solo. And I think on demo there's something. But I was like, I don't have any good idea for it, and I think this is perfect example of the song that doesn't need any fucking guitar solos. And then I think the decision was more or less mine, of course. So I tender, well, if you think that way, well, yeah, I'm okay. In every song there's no need for guitar solos.
When nearing the conclusion of the recording and mixing sessions, Lordi began filming one of the band's most lauded music videos, Blood Red Sandman. However, there was some unnecessary chaos happening back in the studio while Lordi were away shooting the video.
I remember when the A&R guy came to mix this and the band was in the video shooting in that day, and they the first single was still a little bit open while they were already filming the video for the first single, and the A&R studio and was listening to the material, and he started to think if we should change the first single. And whoa, I said, okay. I think it's impossible because they are right now filming the video of the song, so it tells that the plans were really, it was really reactive.
This story is very, very well and clear in the memory how it went.
Okay,
so we were shooting the video. Yeah, we were shooting the video, and I think we have, well, I mean, half the video was already shot. And, you know, back in those days, you know, you would do the storyboard and you would actually shoot it on film, which is not cheap.
Yeah.
You know, so every single frame that is, you know, that was shot, you know, it counts. It actually costs money, and it costs like hundreds of euros. Every single fucking second, it is, you know, it's not like today that you just, you know, the video, and you can take as many takes as you want, and it doesn't cost a dime, you know. The crazy thing is that our A&R at the time, Asko Kallonen, he was in the mastering room in Finvox Studios then, while we were shooting the video, and then he calls me, I remember, and he calls the director, Pete.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if there also was Kimmo Valtanen, who was a marketing director of BMG at the time. But I he called also, there were a lot of phone calls, you know, happening, because when Asko, our A&R at the time, decided all of a sudden, hearing the songs in the mastering, that let's not do Blood Red Sandman as a first single, let's do My Heaven Is Your Hell. We were like, what the fuck are you talking about? We're shooting the video, we're halfway done, it's not possible. And Asko is a fucking idiot in those, and he doesn't care and he doesn't understand. He's like, we just put another song on top of the music video. And he just like, he just couldn't understand that the whole fucking, all the shots were done and carefully planned for Blood Red Sandman. Of course, I mean, the lip sync, not to mention the playing and everything, and it wouldn't work. But he was like, no, this is what we need to do. We need to change the single. And well, eventually, like everybody else, you know, we made him understand that it's not possible. It's not possible. I mean, technically, of course, you can put another song, but you know, if you take the Blood Red Sandman video now and you just add My Heaven Is Your Hell on top of that, it doesn't work. Of course it doesn't. It's stupid as fuck, you know. It's just like, you can see that, okay, this video is not for this song, it's not done for this song. So luckily we got him, you know, we got him to his senses some way that he wouldn't, you know, force that too hard.
On March 15, 2004, the Monster American Dream was unleashed upon the Monster Maniacs, bringing in new listeners to the band and providing original fans with 13 new terrorific tales. Preceding this, the band would of course go on their touring cycle across much of Europe, and they would visit the UK for the first time in 2005. This year would also see Lordi release their first compilation album titled The Monster Show, published by Sanctuary Records to promote the group in the UK and Ireland. Following the conclusion of the tours and this album's era, changes were afoot in the band's lineup. Ennery, Lordi's keyboardist, would be removed from the band due to various issues with other members. Her influence and legacy would leave a great foundation for future members Awa and Hella. K Kalma would also leave the group prior to the Eurocalypse era, but did record bass on that album. His departure was a necessary decision for him, as family was at the centre of it. Although he left the group, he did have one final performance left in him, this being in London, England, in 2006.
I remember my costume was in some kind of exhibition, and the exhibition ended right before that show, or was it right before that tour?
Yeah.
And I went to get my costume from the exhibition. I took it to myself, and then I had the idea. I don't remember that if I got money somewhere from record sales or something. Record company sent me like some royalties,
right.
I think. That, well, I had the money to buy the plane ticket to London, and I was thinking, all of a sudden I got the idea that it would be great to, you know, appear as a surprise on the last show of that tour.
Yeah.
And I just called to the guitar technicians and asked them if how we could, you know, make this happen, what was the easiest way. And we decided, I decided that I would play guitar because it was like maybe, you know, easier to arrange, maybe.
Okay.
Because Jussi had like two cabinets and quite a few guitars, so it was like and all the wireless systems. He had different wireless systems, and I played with Jussi's like backup guitar rig.
Okay.
So it was like, it was really easy to arrange. And I just, you know, played, rehearsed the songs with the guitar. It was really fun.
Yeah.
It was a good reaction.
Ah, okay, cool. There you go.
They were like really, really surprised, but really happy.
Yeah. Ah, that's awesome.
I remember Tommy's face when, you know, the doors opened and I was there playing that song. So he just, you know, took a glance at me and just laughed.
Been playing together, we've known each other 30 years, and we've been playing together 27 years now. So it's something about the personalities, and there's some kind of like yin and yang stuff, you know.
Right.
Nico is not kind of like, he's not like a, you know, kind of like a front man guy.
Yeah.
But he's a great sidekick, you know, and he feels that thing that I need, and I guess vice versa, and at the same time we also have like the taste is pretty much the same, you know. If I like something, okay, I like this, he's kind of like, oh, yeah, me too. And then if he's kind of like, well, I don't like this that much, and I'm kind of like, yeah, I totally agree. It's some weird chemistry, I don't know what it is, and still after 30 years we enjoy others' company, and that's weird.
Yeah.
I think it's, you know, based in our relationship and in our friendship.
Okay.
Because we are quite different people.
Yeah.
We have different personalities, and I think that is one of the, you know, key parts of that, because we like complete each other.
Right, I get you.
In a way.
Yeah.
Because we haven't, you know, I don't remember that we ever argued about anything, or at least not much. It is just working, you know. We both have our own roles on that combination, and it just works.
Kalma and Keita, following the latter's firing from Lordi in 2010, prioritized on working on their old group Stala and So, and to this day perform in various groups together, such as Samsa Astala's solo project, QMA with former Lordi keyboardist Awa and Motika. The Lordi connection is still burning bright to this day. To wrap up our Monsterican Dream anniversary special, we need to look at the legacy that this album provides. For many fans, and myself included in this, this was my first Lordi era as a Monster Maniac, so this album is a major favourite of mine. But for Mr. Lordi and Eamon, their opinions differ to that select group of fanatics.
I think it only stands out to me in a way that was that you know, because you have to compare it to the to previous album, which was the first one. It only stands out to me in a way that it's not as good as Get Heavy. I mean, material wise, it's not as good. It's not as strong. And one of the reasons there is that when we were selecting the songs for Get Heavy, there was like 10 years, you know, to choose from the material. And I was like so eager to write new shit all the time as I would write them as long as Asko is satisfied. And now we have an album. Now we have an album full of, you know, good songs, you know.
Yeah.
But then when the next, you know, and then it kind of like caught me by surprise that now we need to do a new one. So and I started from clean plate, even though, like I said, you know, we went to dig up the vaults from Beaten Bodies and stuff like that. But anyway, there was not that much variety. But while that being said, also when I tried to sneak in a little bit more like that there would be more diversity in the songs, more variety in the songwriting already there on the second album. And Asko was like, no, this is not the time. Not yet. And that's why, for example, Bring It On is kind of, you know, the beginning of it is very complex, very progressive, even you know, the whole thing there. That was something that I wanted to write more, and I wanted to do more. And it was, well, as you know, I Dug a Hole in the Yard for You, that was written for Monsterican Dream already. Yeah. when it came out like 15 years later or something.
Yeah.
You know, that song. Yeah, I really wanted to push more to the metal and progressive and harder style then.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't really that much into the whole trying to get a hooky choruses. And you can hear that on that album, that I wasn't really in that mode or mood while writing those songs. I wasn't really in that much into that. You know, I was like, other aspects of music were interesting, more interesting to me at that moment. I think I really wanted to just show that we can do more than just like Monster and songs like that.
Yeah.
We can actually do. I wanted to open the doors, you know, wider and show people that we are more than that, you know.
Okay.
But Asko said that, and Asko was right. He said, no, it's not the time you should do another album. That is like just like cementing what you had on Get Heavy. You need to build the base and make it strong, and not to, you know, not to confuse people.
Yeah.
You know, okay. Even though he did the biggest confusion with the video, a single choice, but by himself, but still.
Yeah.
And but he was right.
Monsterican Dream kind of it slipped away from me. I don't well, that's the wrong way to say it, but like it happened really fast after the first album, and it just, like we've been talking about a lot about this dark theme, but I don't know where it came from, maybe. And there are still good songs, but...
Thank you for joining us on this very special 20th anniversary look at the Monsterican Dream. I'm grateful for Kita Kalma, Healy Halesma, Eamon and Mr. Lordy for giving their time and insights. And also to Mana, Hisi and Kone, who kindly performed some isolated versions of Wake the Snake and Kalmageddon, which you would have heard layered into this episode. I hope you've enjoyed this special, and stay tuned to Monsters of Rock, the Lordy story, as we'll have some more for you in the near future.
Monsters of Rock, the Lordy story, is a True Metal podcast production. The show is presented, produced, and written by Matthew Kessie. Head to True Metal Pod's social channels to keep up to date with the production.